Welcome to the FMCG podcast. Make sure you're following us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and leave us a five-star review. It really helps us out. Enjoy the show.
Hi, good morning. My name is Rich and we are Consumer Hub and we focus on consumer recruitment. And this is the FMCG podcast where we speak with the leaders that we know and we rate and hear their insights into their category expertise, their technical expertise, and also their insights into leadership for your career. So today we're very, very excited to have Richard Taylor on the show of Brandon Design Consultants over in Greater Manchester. And over to you, Brandon. Over to you, Richard and Brandon. Give us a bit of insight into Brandon, the story there. What's going on? What do you do? And what is your business all about?
No. Thank you for that. That's great. Interesting insight there straight away. My middle name is Brandon. So 12 years ago, when we were registering the company, my wife and I sat in our attic in Halifax and said at the time, if we can't think of a better name than Brandon tomorrow, we're calling it Brandon. Nice. And as you can imagine, we couldn't think of a better name than Brandon. So we did so. A little bit of plotted history, I suppose. I met my wife many moons ago at a Leeds agency called Elmwood, consumer goods focused. And then we moved to the Middle East where I sort of grew up in my formative years. We moved over to WPP at the time, worked at Brand Union for 3 years there. Then we came back to London and worked at Landor Associates for 3 years. So we did a lot of working in WPP organizations and understanding, you know, how brands grow and what the key to brand growth is. And we just at the time wanted to take that learning away. My wife's a designer, so we wanted to take that learning away and set up our own business. And we did that back in 2012, set it up as we were a lifestyle business, we wanted to have children and a dog. Dog came first, children later. We've grown the business year on year to, we're a team of 40 now in Manchester. We're opening up in London and then we're looking at North America in the next couple of years as well. So it's great to be on and thank you for the invitation.
That's really exciting. No, thank you for taking us on a quick run through that. Just wanted to kind of double down into the mission because I'm always really intrigued as to like just what gives people that spark. I know you were saying initially a lifestyle business and the name, a little bit of story, but it's still a big plunge, isn't it? Even if you start with small aspirations and it just grows like topsy, there's always that kind of like idea in the back of your head of like, what do you want it to achieve? Like, what was the sort of the driving sort of force? What was that moment where you thought, oh, actually, I could do something different here? Like, what was it just was the catalyst to kind of get you to do your own hustle, basically?
No, I love that. I think I always look back to people's history and what drives them. Whenever I meet people, I always ask them about their history and their family because I think you can find out what makes people tick. So my dad was a civil and structural engineer in the Middle East, building the roads, the networks, the bridges, the motorways, all of that over the years in the 80s. And then my dad was quite entrepreneurial, so we set up an Irish pub in Belgium, which is crazy. Yes. when you look back at it.
Irish? Have you got the Irish?
This is where my father and I had differing views. It was one of those. We brought in a lot of Irish people to lead the charge, luckily, on my watch. So we've always had entrepreneurship, I suppose, as part of the family. My mother then went on to run a successful cafe in the Peak District called The Three Roofs in Castleton. And she sold that and retired and done really well. So we've always had that entrepreneurial spirit in the business. And I think we saw the good bits of WPP and we saw the bad bits of WPP. And we just wanted to create a different type of entity that served, you know, that served people well, gave really good advice, and helped those businesses grow through brands and exploiting the potential in brands. Our positioning now is around how we awaken brand potential. And we think there's too much untapped potential in brands that people sometimes just don't know how to unlock. So that's our role in the world, is to try and help them unlock that potential.
Yeah, great. So that's really interesting. I was going to ask you that mission, so leading me nicely onto it. But can you kind of unpack that a little bit for me? Like, what does that sort of look like in practical terms? You know?
Yeah, no, it's really useful. I suppose I'll give you one of the programs we've worked with. We worked with a company called Horlicks. Well, it's Amir Foods that bought the brand from GSK, and Horlicks was a brand that was sort of like, my mother's had it since she was 10 and my mum's in her 80s now, and it was starting to lose its way. A great heritage brand that had so much passion around it, and the sort of GSK way at the time just looked quite pharmaceutical, and it had the wheat fields and the the malt was coming through that, and you could just see where they were going with the whole identity on design, but it didn't really resonate with people. And we were going through that sort of cultural movement of Hygge, where we were looking, this is pre-COVID, where we were looking for the world to slow down. And so we looked at the sort of residual dominant emerging codes. So what's happening in the market? Residual codes are codes that have been there for a long time. Dominant codes are what sort of the big players play, and then what's emerging in category. So there's a new visual language coming through with a lot of illustration being used, which we see now from some of the challenger brands like Dalston, behind you. And we looked at that, and we looked at around, it was, Horlicks was by and large known as a brand that makes you go to sleep or helps you go to sleep. And we turned it into a brand that helps you relax. So how could we bring relaxation through? So if you look at the packaging now, we've got a beautiful illustration on there. The product intrinsic is there, but the sort of steam that comes off the Horlicks is a little road or a river taking you mentally somewhere else. So it's a little bit akin to Kit Kat. It's taking you away from the day-to-day, because we had this insight that, the mums and they're the mainstay of consumers. One of the insights we learned is if you can get mums in their 70s to get their daughters in their 30s and 40s to consume Horlicks, it becomes a ritual. So that was a great insight that we learned. So we basically took that into an identity, and then we propelled that forward, and then took that across everything that they do as a brand, and moving them from that position of sleep to relaxation, and helping people relax. And you can imagine through COVID, the stress and strenuous situations they're facing, many people with mental health, the brand just grew and grew, cemented its position at number one and stretched its position over its number two behind. So that's just one little case where we've done that. And we've worked with a lot of heritage brands like Thornton's Chocolate, Birdseye, Napolina, Tin Tomatoes, Olive Oil. So we've worked in lots of different categories where we've got heritage brands that need to unlock that potential. And we've been really good at doing that and achieving commercial growth for those organizations.
Right. That's really interesting. Just talking about that mission there that you touched earlier. Sounds like you've got a really clear process taking it from like insight through to ideation and then the design and then the feedback. Can you just, for anyone that's watching that's never done anything with a brand design agency before and they don't really understand how it all works, can you just give us a window into like what actually goes on behind the scenes? Because that'd be really interesting to understand.
It's like a mystic art, and if you go behind the door of any agency in the design agency world, they follow a similar process of discovery. I mean, we've got discovery, definition, design, and deploy. It's four. We call it the four Ds. It's really simple. But the discovery phase is the bit that a lot of people don't really gel into and get and dig into. So we look at it as, again, I'm quite a simpleton. So we look at it across ABC, audience, brand, and context. What do we know about our audience? What do we know about our brand? And what do we know about the context in which it lives, be that competitors or culture? And so you look at that as discovery phase and it's about doing your homework, really understanding where you are and the gaps that you might have. And then it's about, you go into that definition phase and you might test different hypotheses. So when I looked and talked about Horlicks, one could be about relaxation. One could be about energy. And you test different propositions to see which resonate with your audience that are buying the brand today, and then who you'd like to buy it tomorrow. So that, and then you go into a design phase where you've got clarity of where you are positioned in the market, and then it's bringing to that life in different creative ways. And you explore two or three ways. You can test it with consumers in focus groups where it's, sit behind a mirror, there's eight people there. You do two focus groups in the north of England, two in the Midlands, two in the south, and you review what their outputs are to help steer you and help guide the thinking of where you're at and where your own gut feel is. Mm-hmm. Or you do, and you often can do quant as well. So you quantitatively can, especially with heritage brands, because if you go into the likes of Tesco or any of the major retailers, they want to know that you've tested this. If I'm putting something new on my shelf, I need to know it's better than the one that's gone before. So that's often easier to quantify with commercial numbers, from tests of 100, 200 plus people to try and resonate and see which design has a strong resonance with that audience and is going to win the battle at shelf.
That's really interesting. No, thanks for walking through that. That's fascinating. What do you do to ensure that it doesn't become death by committee? Because if there's a lot of voices on that journey with you, I guess you've got to have a clear vision and someone that almost sort of maintains that and safeguards it throughout the whole process.
Yeah, I mean, one of our values that's lived through, and I think this is where we differ, is we're quite frank with our clients. It's that sort of, it's that 10,000 hours of learning. that Malcolm Gladwell talked about, you sort of know intuitively what's right and wrong, and we expect the client partners that work with us to trust us and let us lead the way. I often sort of, the where it usually breaks down is where you've got too many opinions. You know, there was that famous phrase, I think, about you've never seen a statue of a committee. And I think, you know, it's you can get there. And you know, you look at business leaders, like, you know, before it was Steve Jobs at Apple, and now you could sort of say Elon Musk, you've got dictators in many ways at Tesla. But that's how you often have to get things through. So I think a strong marketing lead is really important in an organization that's fighting at board level. And, you know, that's where qual and quant data can be useful to help shape the thinking, but not make the decision. And good marketers use it to steer their thinking, not to make their thinking. So it's never an easy one to walk down in terms of working with client partners in that way. What we try to do is guide client partners with our expertise from our strategy team, our design team, and our client service team, so we get the optimum result.
Right, that's really interesting. You must love it. It's your business. You've been doing it for years, but. Like, what gets you out of bed in the morning? Like, what is it that really gives you the juice when it comes to, you know, the projects that you work on?
Ideas that transform business. You know, I drive to work every morning, get up early, get into work. I love what I do. I love growth. I love any form of growth. And I think that, like I said, I think there's a lot of untapped potential in brands and in the consumer goods world. I think it's becoming ever more difficult to stand out and be different and distinctive. So for me, it's about ideas that transform business, and that's what we do to unlock that potential. And that excites me. And, you know, if you can't be excited by, you know, creativity, strategy, and great client service, you shouldn't be doing what we do.
And just on that point there, kind of building on what you've been saying about, like, you know, the value that you offer clients, like, where is your business positioned in the market, like brand, and, you know, like, what is the way that you sort of talk about yourselves sort of externally? Because I appreciate you've been explaining to me in layman's terms what you do, but, like, say you're out there, you're pitching, or you're kind of taking the business to market, you know, how do you sort of just summarize everything that you do down and sort of differentiate from what is a crowded market, because there's a lot of different agencies, aren't there?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that unlocking brand potential is a core to what we do, and it's not to be seen as the pack agency, which people can pigeonhole you in. So what we look at is identity in its totality. So what's the 360 experience? What's the experience that can drive brands through distinctive assets? Understanding, you know, we've just done some work with a major restaurant chain in the UK that serves pizzas. I can't tell you who it is, but you can work it out. But you look at the distinctive assets that are at play, and what can we leverage, and what can help that brand maintain its position or grow or extend its leadership. So we're really good at trying to unlock that potential, and I think it's the art and science of design. I think there's too much art. There's too many design studios that do nice design that might stand out, might be easy to select, but is it sticky? Is it people emotively connecting to it? And I often think they don't. So again, I think people come to us that want a slightly different point of view than they would do from the major, let's say, London agencies that you'd see, and the international network. So we, you know, when we go up against those companies, we tend to win 2 in 3 of the pitches. The run rate of pitches in our world, usually you win 1 in 3. And I think it's something unique that we do. There's a few things that we do in the process and how we work. That's slightly different around storytelling, and then bringing brands to life through emotion, not just through static visuals. So there's lots of little things that we do that cumulatively build a larger effect. But really, it's understanding the businesses we work with, the brand at play, and the potential for that brand or the brand portfolio, and helping the brands and businesses grow. You know, we're here for commercial market gain, and that's something we've won a number of design business effectiveness awards, and effectiveness is really key for us. So having clarity, any marketeer, when you go to a design agency, have clarity on what you're trying to achieve from a business level, and then what you're trying to achieve from a brand level, and be really clear about that from the outset. Gareth Turner, who's been on your podcast before, I was with him recently. We were talking about, you know, creative brief writing. You know, creative brief writing has become lazy. There's not been as much thought put into it. It's almost like, I'll just throw it at the agency and they'll answer all my problems. And it's like, well, no, we need to let's work on what we're trying to do at a business level, what we're trying to do at a brand level, and how design can empower that. So yeah, there's a lot. The industry's changing a lot, and I think creative brief writing is just one thing that needs to improve. And we do a lot of work with our clients before we even, you know, start to go into that discovery phase. It's trying to understand and net out what the objectives are, because as these organizations go back to board level, they have to justify why they're doing what they're doing. And if you've got the clarity there on quant and qual in terms of what you're trying to achieve, it's much more feasible, and then we can measure it post the program going live.
Yeah, right. That's really interesting. Thanks for sort of walking me through the detail on that. So something that I wanted to ask you about, Richard, is shopper marketing, because in your space, that's just a massive value that you add when you talk about unlocking potential. Can you sort of just give me an insight into what is shopper marketing and how does a brand stand out on shelf? Because it is a bit of a dark art. And I know you've said before about combining art and science. I really like that. So just walk me through, what is shopper marketing for those that are interested in the science of it? Like, how can people get most impact at shelf?
Yeah, no, I think there's often a, and this is back, it goes back to unlocking brand potential. A lot of marketeers just get the pack ready and just put it on the shelf and hope, and they don't see the experience. You know, they spend a hell of a lot of time invested in comms that nobody sees, and it's really difficult. Your best opportunity is at point of purchase. So how can you enliven and make that experience more relevant for people? And there's lots of different tactics that you can do from outside, you know, from walking outside, from sampling to seeing digital ad boards as you walk in a supermarket, as then you walk down the aisle, there might be some graphics on the floor in terms of vinyls. Then when you get to fixture, there might be some wobblers or things that visually disrupt you and make it easy for you to be picked up and yeah, help you stand out above the competitive set. I was speaking to the founder, Paul Baker at Saint Pierre Group, a few months ago, and they've got the Brioche brand, and it's more famous in the US than it is in the UK.
In the States.
Yeah, it's got a lot more traction, and Paul's got, I mean, you need to get Paul on the podcast, he's amazing, but their story is crazy. But they did this Eiffel Tower. Obviously, Saint Pierre, French, Parisian bakery. Let's leverage all the equity we can from that into Saint Pierre as a brand. And they did this Eiffel Tower standing unit with the brioche that stood on it. And I could pretty much say that has been one of the biggest marketing initiatives that business will have done that will have transformed its fortunes in North America. Because, you know, when we're walking around the supermarket, we're stopped by shape and colour are the two things. And there's lots of arguments. Some people say it's colour first, some people say it's shape first. But if you're walking around a supermarket and there's this Eiffel Tower stand with, you know, shelves on it of brioche bread, you're like, what the? Because it's disrupting your brain. And we talk when I talked earlier about the science of what we do, a lot of what we do is looking at neurodesign. It's looking at design triggers that happen in our brain. And one, you know, just what's making us stop and what's making us go, oh, that doesn't look right. And that's one of those triggers, is just to try and make sure that people can go, oh, error, that's not right. What's that there for? Why is there an Eiffel Tower here? And that error bias makes you go, oh, I'll lean into that because it's interesting and it's triggered my brain. Because we see so much communication, and, you know, you're walking around a supermarket and you're average seeing anywhere from 20,000 to 30,000 products, and you usually buy from 100 of those. And so to get you to change your behavior, you have to have something that's going to make you stop in your tracks. So I think that's just a perfect example of a great piece of shop marketing that really worked for that brand and really took off. Now, it's difficult for them to replicate that in the UK because we've not got as big a stores as Walmart, for example. You might get it in some of the bigger Tesco or Asda superstores where you've got more space for sort of freestanding display units. But yeah, I think that's there's a lot more energy and effort now focused on shopper marketing than ever before, because people know that you can quantify the results of what's happened in store and make a difference, you know, be it buying a gondola end and spending the money on the gondola end to get your brand noticed. If you've got a portfolio of brands like Napolina, who we've worked with previously, or Heinz do a really good job of that. So yeah, I think you've just got to look at your environment in which you're sold and see how you can stand out beyond the core packaging. I mean, one of the things that often people forget again is just the shelf ready packaging that the products come in. So if you were looking at Dalston, if you're looking at Dalston behind you, if it's in a little tray that's around there, what can you do on the tray that sends a message to communicate Dalston's natural credentials or whatever they're trying to promote as their marketing position? So yeah, there's a lot more work I think can be done, and I think brand managers are so busy just doing the do that they sometimes don't have anybody to guide them on that journey. And I think that's when I talked to you earlier about, you know, how our role is basically provoke client partners with what else can we be doing to make this brand successful on shelf or online.
So just speak for you and your business there, like what are the growth opportunities? Like where do you see opportunities for the business? Sounds like international is part of that, but you know, what are you excited about moving forwards?
Yeah, no, you've touched on it a little bit there. We've started working quite a lot internationally across Europe and into North America. We open a studio in London in the next 2 or 3 months, and with that then opens up more multinational client partners that we're speaking to and starting to work with. And then, you know, North America is a big market. We've done some work in North America recently. And if I put it in simpleton terms, there's basically too many design firms in the UK and not enough work. So when I speak to peers now, and I speak to quite a lot in the industry, there's a lot of design agencies that are struggling in the UK right now. We're in growth, and I attribute that growth to moving beyond these shores. So like I say, you know, working in Finland, Sweden, Belgium, France, Spain, North America, Mexico. So we've seen growth come from international waters, and I think that's part of the times we live in. The UK's been hit economically. There's a lot of uncertainty. I just feel like there's a swell of positivity coming through post summer, which I've spoken to a few people about. But yeah, we mitigated risk by internationalizing the business, and you know, we work more now with international companies than we do those locally.
Interesting. It's very similar parallel for us actually. We're probably up 60% in the US and Europe now, Middle East. And 2 years ago, I wouldn't have predicted that. But it's gone. You trial it, it works, and then you double down on it, you get a good return, and you just keep going. That's part of the fun of it. It's just tinkering with the model and see where it goes.
Yeah, and I think for what we do, great British design travels well. You know, it's you know, in any market in the world, British design is still revered as, you know, number one or number two by most people. So it travels really well. And you know, when you go into North America, there is a bit of these strange Brits phenomenon, and it's like, but I'm intrigued by it. So if you try and go and get a meeting with a multinational company in North America, it'll be a hell of a lot easier than getting one in London, because in London they're plagued by 30 emails a week of outreach, you know, just spam. And they're like, I haven't got time for this. I know who the good people are. I know who I'm going to work with. When you go to the States, if you pick the right partners and express why you think you're relevant to their business and what you can show that you've done before for either similar categories or similar challenges they're facing, they're much more open to going, okay, well, this, you know, this Brit's traveled across the pond. I'm happy to engage a conversation. Now, you've got to go from there to close a deal. But I just think great British design travels really well. And if you look in North America, the majority of the design firms that are doing well there are British design firms with an outreach in North America. So, and I'm not the only one that's looking at that. Most of my sort of industry peers in challenger branding agencies like ourselves are looking to North America for growth.
Nice. Yeah. Try to replicate that British invasion from the 60s in music. Let's do it.
Yeah, but it is that, you know, popular culture. We've not talked about that, but popular culture resonates, and Britain has a great, you know, we're known for music, we're known for fashion, we're known for design. And I think that still transcends into the States, and it works really well. And if you go to, you know, when you go to North America, there's some really good design work done by a handful of good design firms, but there's a lot of average, and I mean really bad. I mean like average. So it wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't last on shelf in the UK more than a couple of weeks before thrown off. But so this, you know, again, talking about untapped potential, I think there's a lot of brand potential to awaken in North America, and I'm excited. I suppose that partly, you know, you asked earlier about what gets you up in the morning. I think that's one of the things, is to help business grow through brand and empowering that through creativity and ideas.
Nice. Right. No, that's great. It's great. Just thinking about leadership then. So, you kind of talked me through a lot of the sort of the ins and outs stages, which is great. Just kind of get this kind of inside view. But like, what does it actually look like to be a founder in your business, and more generally, like how we found the founder experience? Because that's something that people really love about the show, is we try and speak to industry leaders and corporates, but also we speak to smaller companies where they're founder-led. And just that founder journey, take us through what it's just like mentally, some of the ups and downs, just anything you think is good for people to understand and realise.
I mean, it differs year on year. And as you grow, you're less, like, obviously, when we started off, Abby and I, my wife and I, it was ourselves in an attic and a dog with us in a small terrace cottage in the Calderdale Valley, where Happy Valley was filmed. And it was, you know, it's, you do everything, you know, you just do everything. You're doing the legals, you're doing the financials, you're doing invoice. I mean, I remember printing out invoices and sending them to people. You do absolutely everything. As you grow in time, you then have a leadership team under you that can then take the mainstay of the work. And we've got head of strategy, leading client partner and creative director that take on the mainstay of the work that needs to be done. My focus more recently now is more about growth. Of what do we as a business do, setting a vision, setting a three-year plan, and then making sure that we deliver against that plan. So I spend a lot of time meeting new potential client partners. I spend a lot of time meeting new people that can join the business. And then I look at trends and look at what's happening in the industry and what can we learn and how can we evolve what we do in terms of learning and development. And we're constantly evolving our product and the way that we work. But yeah, no, you know, I smiled earlier because there's no 2 days no 2 days are the same. But yeah, your focus is much more now on growth of the agency and making sure that we're delivering against awakened brand potential for all of our client partners now and helping them, you know, helping them grow. It's a really difficult time to be a marketeer at the moment. It's there's just so much they have to do, and that, you know, I always say the meeting with us should be the best meeting they have that week. It should be fun, enjoyable, directive, pointy. And I think that's something that comes from our sort of Frank values about just making sure we give people really good advice.
Right. And for sort of talent coming through, they're committed to developing excellence in marketing. They want to be in that agency space. They want the buzz. They want the excitement. It is tough at the moment. What advice would you have for people on the sort of the mindset and the character attributes that they need to hone alongside the skills to be successful in talent coming through?
Passion. If you're in this industry, you've got to be in it. You probably sensed, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, you've got to have passion for the industry. You've got to have passion for what you're doing. You have to be committed. You have to almost, if you're coming in for an internship and going into a design agency in that way, you need to be the first person there in the morning, the last person there. You need to become invaluable. You need people to go, we can't let that person not join us. And I think there's too much, I see too much passiveness. I see people come in and meander around and just don't. And, you know, they might be a bit frightened by the environment because it's quite a fast, you know, fast-paced environment. But really, to make a mark, you've got to have a voice. You've got to really get stuck in. You've got to deliver. You've got to make someone's life better. Improve it, make it easier for them to do their job. And I think that only comes through from passion. If you've not got passion, you've got nothing. You can't really do anything. I've seen too many students come through the ranks and just go, where's your, you know, you want to shake them and go, what's inside? You've got something. What is it? What is it? What are you about? So yeah, you're looking, I just look for that passion. And you know, we've done really well over the years. One of our big things is about promoting people and getting them to grow, and we've done a lot of work with the universities in the north of England to bring people through. So Sheffield Hallam, for example, got a great design team there, and I know Pam really well, and we've brought through, I think, 6 designers.
Just a phenomenal university, like one of the best really, yeah. Equipping students, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're close. I think it's always about being close to commerce, and I think they've got that nailed pretty well. So yes, I think they're a really good. I think that's a really good way of just, you know, you've got to invest in the next generation of talent, and we've done really well. Like I say, one of our team has been promoted recently to design director, and I'm sure he'll be a creative director in the next couple of years without a shadow of a doubt. And just seeing, you know. I always say to the business that, and the senior leadership team within the business, that, you know, the commercials are one thing. It's like a cricket score. If you do all the other things right, you'll start scoring the runs and the commercials will get to where you need to be. But what excites me more is seeing people grow. And I think our team, we've just got a phenomenal team of people that have that passion. You know, when you're a small to medium-sized business, you can't afford to carry dead weight. When you're in a WPP network, there's quite a bit of dead weight. It's just inevitable. It's nothing to do with WPP being a bad company. It's just you've got that many people and that much volume. You can hide a little bit more when they're there. Whereas if you're in a small to medium sized, you really need to show your value.
Yeah. Right. That's very interesting. So hone the fire, tend the fire, hone the blade, tend the fire.
Just look for the fire within. Where's the fire in your belly? You know. And I'll sometimes say that to people. I say, what gets you up at night? Why are you what keeps you awake at night? Or what gets you up in the morning? You know, why do you want to be here? Why do you want to do what you want to do? And I'm not being provocative for provocative sake. I'm trying to get to understand the human being that's in front of me to help them.
Yeah. I think that's invaluable as well from a manager. I mean, there's a lot of managers that are happy to have people go stale, you know, on their own clock and then chop them, or that they steam in there and they just measure them by output without getting underneath the values and the drivers that are delivering that poor output. So I was really just happy to have that chat and challenge somebody's mindset, and that's invaluable. I definitely benefited from previous managers in the past, and I definitely not benefited from people that have been too much like a steamroller or not spending enough time to kind of understand their kind of the reasons why the output is in there. That's really interesting.
The only point I was going to say is I think it's really about like investing in the people and putting the time into the people. You can sometimes get so entrenched in the, you know, you can't see the wood for the trees because you're knee deep in the woods. So I think just sticking your head above the parapet, speaking to your people individually and saying like, well, what is it you're trying to achieve? What are the three things you need to achieve in the next quarter? And then meeting them in a month's time to say, right, how have you helped? How can I, you know, agreeing what they are together, don't just dictate them, but agree what they are together. Come back in a month's time, review them, see how you're doing. Come back another month's time, review them, reset them potentially, because one might have moved and you might have got a new one that's come in. And I think that it's the duty of leaders to help empower those people, but give them, you know, give them clear vision and give them some direction to go. You know, it's, you give people a piece of rope, see what they do with it. And they can run as far. It's up to the individual to have the nature, but you need to embrace them with the culture and the right humankind to help them grow.
Absolutely. Per your point about growth as well, I think, you know, the businesses that get the people down on it right, they are the businesses that grow, aren't they? Because fundamentally, you can never do everything as a founder or a director, can you? You know, you have to activate, empower, pass the strategy on and let it be inculcated, owned by the people that work with you. Otherwise, it's just not going to have a life of its own, is it?
No. I can't remember the exact phrase, but there was a, Richard Branson had one which was around hire people that are better than you and then get out of the way. A lot of business leaders are scared to hire people that are better than them. And I'm like, why would I not hire someone that's better than me? Because I'm only going to learn from them. Otherwise, who am I learning from? I can learn from my peers to a degree. So yeah, I always say that, you know, hire people that are better than you. But there's also, you know, it puts people out. There's an ego there. There's a, you know, am I not good enough? But you've got to hire, you know, if you guide people in the right way, you can hire people that are better than you and let them take you to the next level. And, you know, we're just about to open up London and we've got a couple of people that are coming in there that are going to really, you know, take us to the next level. And I'm so excited about that. Because I think it'll be, you know, it's another, you know, each, when I look at a business, it's like in life, you're just taking another step up each day and you're trying to move forwards. I think too many people are scared to just hire great talent because they could be difficult or they could be this or, and it's like, just hire the people that aren't going to kill your culture, but are going to take you forward and lead you. And like I said, then like Branson, get out of the way.
Yeah, I love that. Just as a kind of party chat for people, any resources, books that you recommend that just help people in their own sort of personal development journey?
I'm trying to think of that. There's lots of different books. I mean, one of the ones that I've always liked for the designers is a book called Smile in the Mind, which you might have seen, but it's basically a graphic book and it's all the little things that people have designed over the years that just make you smile. And we're here about, you know, we're here to change emotion. And if we change emotion, it leads to a change of consumer purchase. And I think that that's a great book to just for anyone, client service, creative or strategies to pick up, look through and you know, hopefully make you smile. But it's the one I turn to time and time again. And I know it's the one, it's been a number of different editions of it and they add to it. And each time they do it, every design agency in the UK wants to get one of their pieces of work in there. So for us, hopefully Horlicks could be the one.
Love that. Okay. No, well, thanks so much for sharing all your insights, Richard. It's been great to have you on the show. Look, if you've been listening, watching, please reach out to Richard, thank him for his time. People come on the show because they want to invest in careers in FMCG, in marketing, innovation, sales, etc. And also make sure you follow Richard and Brandon. Richard's got some great content. I follow him on LinkedIn, it's really good. And thanks so much for listening, everyone. It's been great to have you, and we look forward to seeing you again on the FMCG podcast. Have a great day.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for watching the FMCG podcast. Click the playlist here to hear more great episodes. You can also find us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search the FMCG podcast to hear more great content. See you soon.